Tonight we're delighted to have Tom Pollen here, not least because Jermaine Greer also works at the university, and so we almost have the full complement of the late review here, and the late show. And not least too because Tom's new book, The Wind Dog, is to my mind his best book of poems, not least because of the titles, which I've written a few down. They're a poem in themselves. The Utile as Fetish, The Unholy One, For to Forgiveness, Odd Surname, and Le Crapaud. Now, he's a poet, I think, much concerned with both language and, if you like, the voice's music. And also, I should mention this too, I think he's one of our most intelligent poets, and they are but few. Ladies and gentlemen, Tom Pollen.
Very nice to be back here. I remember some years ago I came here with Seamus Heaney and Bernard O'Donoghue, and we gave a reading in the Arts Centre. It was in a different room, and there was a concert going on somewhere, classical concert. It's very nice. I begin with it. It's a short poem. It's called Kingstown St. Vincent. I've never been. It's about the experience of trying to ring there. One of my sons had gone a couple of summers ago, and I had the phone number written on a scrap of paper. I think it's about more than that. Piece of paper that's been wet and dried. It's a different texture, rougher, a bit like a voice from the other side, or the ricochet of a chuff's cry, or the way a voice might move from lettuce to rocket. Still a green leaf, but peppery, tougher. I feel it folded in my pocket and know it's dull, dull and stained, that I've written your address in it and that more, much more is giving me pain. Just touching it is like finding a letter of love or a personal letter blowing down the street, so that it feels used, dirty, torn open, like a cross between a bus ticket square of grey print and an unfinished sonnet. Poem I wrote was it, year before last. You'll be familiar with the annual standoff between the Orange Order and the security forces on the Gervaki Road, and this was the year when Molan, who was then Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, said, "Right to the Orange men, you will not march down the Gervaki Road," and everything went like that, and Paisley appeared, and I wrote this poem called Drumcree 4. The preacher. You know that cost of overreacher, the mate of Bible-bashing lectures, says the 12th will be the settling time, then reaches for his blackthorn and marches to the barricade. No more flicks this time of the orange card. They're in a tribal huff. It is a standoff. I listen to the radio. I read the papers. But how this caper will end, no one knows. Only the word settle. It's clanky. It's metallic. Even archaic sound hits the ear like listening to a battered kettle or a tin can being kicked across a patch of rocky ground or concrete walkway. Should we cut an eye patch for the parrot preacher, then snap his stick? He claims this patch of ground's his tribe's alone, and through a megaphone he gulders with a deep, thick, ululating, wheezing sound that strains like Ulster in a bulging holster. That Bible uniform, pressed by what his father stuck to. Now watch the British state, as with fairness and no hate it grasps the nettle and says, "Walk? No way." This poem I got asked to do a translation of Leopardi. I think every Irish poet got asked to translate a Leopardi poem. And the book eventually appeared. And I had never seen so many misprints in a book. My poem had, I think, three. I've never read it before. So I'll have a go at it. It's called Sentence Sound. Part of this book is about, you know, trying to find out what poetry is. When I was young, about 15 or so, 5 or 6 pages in a Fontana paperback on how the ear is the only true reader, the only true writer, took me into that uncurtained attic dedicated to the muse. Here poems are often put together out of fricatives, labials and peachy vowels. Here prose is stretched or polished so that it doesn't try imitate the clearness of that blank window pen. Because I was taken to this attic, I admired the workbench, its wood, all thick and pitted, used but sort of raw, like a floor joist or a railway sleeper. I admired too the drills, gimlets, bradawls, hammers, punches. Even though, in more than an hour's searching, I couldn't find a single file, I searched and searched, missing the raspy texture of the thing, until I lifted a long metal tongue, worn quite smooth out of the waste bin. I licked, no lisped, that smooth file, till it tasted like either hand of a stopped clock. Again, I think it was 2-3 years ago, I got involved in a controversy over a book published by Anthony Julius on T.S. Eliot and anti-Semitism. I noticed that nobody had reviewed this book, really, and I did a review of it for the London Review of Books, and sort of talked partly about the way in which the book had been ignored. And then I went to see this Chagall exhibition in the Royal Academy, and there is this wonderful painting Chagall did of himself and his first wife Bella flying over Vitebsk, the village, the shtetl that he came from. And I noticed that in the foreground there was a little figure like somebody out of a Bruegel having a shite. And I saw this, I mean, it's a very famous painting, but then I saw that the gallery, the Royal Academy, had reproduced this in often postcard size, framed, but the frame just managed to cut this person out, which changed it. And I meditated on this is a rather throwaway poem. It's meant to annoy. It's called Mark Chagall Over the Town. Mark and Bella are flying happily over Vitebsk. They've shucked off the iron husk of place, and like 2 salmon trout have leapt high above the flood, above war, revolution's pogroms. This is a rail, a shining good. But if you look closely, there's a lout squatting on the mud near the fence, like a Bruegel peasant. He's laying a turd at the edge of their wedding party, and it isn't hard to know how serious his face and his bare bum are. Though many a reproduction mars this famous painting by omitting not just his arse, but the entire squatting lout, whose absence reminds me how quite a few critics of T.S. Eliot choose either to forgive or forget those bits of verse and one piece of coldly sinister prose that are about his fear and hatred of all Jews. Part of the subject has a subject in this this book is what's called naive or primitive art, and I've long been haunted by a sentence in Tess of the D'Urbervilles. I found over the years my students had to listen to me saying, you know, isn't this really interesting sentence, very fascinating, and I don't think they were very impressed by my enthusiasm for it. So eventually I sort of bounced the poem out of it. The poem's called Style with an I. I'll read the sentence. It's the one word appertaining that haunts me in it. It's the steam thresher passage late in the novel. Close under the eaves of the stack and as yet barely visible was the red tarrant that the women had come to serve. A timber frame construction with wheels and straps appertaining. The threshing machine, which, whilst it was going, kept up a despotic demand upon the endurance of their muscles and nerves. Gaucherie was Gauguin's term for the style he was after. He gazed on it like Narcissus, till it owned his own features. Try find it, though, in a printed text, and the sentences, gawky or a tad misshapen, spelt wrong or babu even, tend to provoke laughter. Because most critics, they're vexed by what's clumsy or naive. It must never happen that something other than platonic form or hammered gold or pure gold leaf, that gold airy thinness bit, should touch us or should warm the playful, serious, wondering, great, mischievous child in most of us. I mean, take that word appertaining. So dogged, dolty, so pedantic. A plodsome term, completely daft, that makes a fuss and yet it's in its exact legal decorum is like a constable who tries to sing and gets away with it. Not murder. For to be clumsy in one light is to be deft, even graceful. Graceful, not slick, in another. Since David, I wasn't going to read this, in fact, I've never tried to read it before, but David asked me whether I'd read it. I've many times passed just through the town of Chesterfield. Indeed, I once remember I did stop there once, or got dropped off there once, and in a larking way had a pint of awful beer and then caught a train. But in Chesterfield there is this church, and the steeple is buckled. It's completely skewed, and I've seen it, I suppose, the last 20 years, up and down, going to Sheffield. And I wrote this poem a couple of years about it. I don't know what the name of the church is. It's a buckled arrow, pointed like any spire at the sky above the town, or a leaf that has turned from greenness to a brittle, a crumpled brown. Or else it's a cracked bell that rings its muddy, mardy tone every time you look up and wonder at the dinge, the twist on the flank of this oddly angled flesh that balances just like a question mark over the house of God and asks, am I loved, or does God exist? It might be a broken bone that's badly set, or a fragment of the dark, even a screamer shriek like a bat trapped in the belfry, or maybe a squeaky rhythm that keeps trying to sort itself out and get back, whatever are you at, either to Eden or heaven. Some place that doesn't itch, that's perfect and normal, with never a dropped stitch, hitch, missing rhyme or tune. What it's like to live with this perpetual scringe every day of your life in the same small town. It's like a child's gawky drawing, a naive sketch of the real thing, whose leaf-like look is in fact the real thing. And that's plain awkward. Another breach in nature. Unmistakable grief or song that poor creature's dinged every time the music begins. Either that or a squawky rooster perched above the roofs, its cry a tin can being kicked all over town. Does each citizen of this almost forgotten market town, if that's what it is, does each citizen cringe whenever they catch sight of this rusted hinge into the Anglican heaven? Or does it hang like a cliff, fair to say crapulent, over their steady lives, a starvation diet like a permanent Lent or reminder of sin, those years in the desert? Or do these stoic burghers simply shrug and say, Abinett's a false note, but catch that homey dissonance and its bing-dring turns into a grin? I read another Drumcree poem. This is a bit longer, I've slightly lost it, but I'll hope to find it. I'll explain this. This was the Drumcree march before the one I just read about. And what happened was the Orange Order converged on Drumcree with David Trimble and Ian Paisley to the fore. And the Northern Ireland Secretary, Molan, judged, I think rightly, that if she didn't let them march down the road, the civil war would break out. And she did, but then the following year she stopped them. And I had, round about, well, at that time, I live in Oxford, and got invited out to, it was a lunch party, and I kept listening to the radio, and I'd been doing something I don't do very often, a bit of gardening, and I have these big red stepladders. I have a neighbour, he lives across the road, and he's always locking himself out of his house. And I don't know why he hasn't given us a key, but he's given us these huge stepladders, and occasionally he locks himself out, and he comes and gets his own stepladders and gets into his bedroom. And then we get the ladders back. And when we first met him, I'm very fond of him, and he's very, very well-spoken. And he said to me one time, he said, you're from the north of Ireland. He said, my great-grandfather was Prime Minister of Northern Ireland. I said, that's very interesting, Aidan. There haven't been too many of them. Which one was it? He said, Lord Craig of Vaughan. I said, no, Lord Craig Avon. That's who it was. So I associate his first Unionist Prime Minister with these stepladders. And I came down in the morning after this Drumcree march, and there, ghostly in the dawn, were the red stepladders. And I wrote this poem. It's just a few pages. Drumcree 3. On the day of Drumcree, I took an old pair of red stepladders out of the garden shed and set them by a wall where there's an overgrown vine, overgrown and unkempt because the poor plant faces more or less west. And just as I almost never garden, so its grapes stay small, green and bitter, show more dust than ripe bunches ever do, and always look a bit dead. I climbed the tall and slightly unsteady ladder and started hackling the vine, all the time careful of a nest, an abandoned thrush's nest, with three blue eggs dabbled with olive. Eggs no live scaldy had ever crack, they lay there like a line break that doesn't quite work. As I got stuck into the vine, I could hear on the news, on the radio news, how the police were hacking a path through the Garvaki residence so that a line of orange men in hundreds could walk, that is, march, down to the church. I felt tense. Tried a phrase from Horace, it didn't actress Hames make too much sense, and kept working the secateurs. Then we went to a party in East Hendred, drove home in the dark like a pair of deserters, and hit the sack with a soft crash. I woke at dawn and went down to my study to discover a steep red triangle still standing on the lawn outside the window. Standing or parked? For it's not quite the same thing, and the step shade of red looked more like a dulled matter in that early light. Light so frilling early, it walks cat-footed through curtains like an idea. Which means that sheer steep triangle, it might have dropped from the sky all at once. The way ideas were said to have fallen in Europe when Toland was teaching Irish to Leibniz. Or else the ladder was a Jacob's ladder out of a triumphal arch. Derry Ochram, the usual no surrender, a Masonic chunk that had somehow landed in a garden by the Thames, almost like a set theme that can't ever be broken into bits, a kind of dry dream. Except the thing looked more like it had risen out of the earth or been planted on the grass like a tiny gantry or miniature derrick. The sort you see all over Texas flexing one arm as though they were king of each patch of desert, like a doubly belittled, more recent Ozymandias. Then again it appeared, like a type of cubist hard metal liberty tree. As I stared at this abstract, rather emptied and formal, opened out symbol, object or symbol, as I looked at this spook, this bloody maddening steel stook, it began in its dumb way, like an open book, to sing thing, 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 till almost, and I stress almost, it looked like a dragon's tooth that had just popped out of the earth, and a witch that had been trapped.
I'll read this. I should read. Well, I'll have a go at this.
This is about some years ago. Hugo Williams and I, as I mentioned in this, it's just a throwaway poem. We published books. Well, it must have been 1994. Yeah, we published a book each, and we went to Belfast. We were asked to go and read. And I grew up in Belfast, and it's an unforgiving city if you move away from it. And so you go back, and there is that sort of sense that from people you meet that really you betrayed everyone by going away. So you feel guilty, but maybe only up to a point. This is called Forgiveness. We're catching the shuttle, Hugo Williams and me, to give a poetry reading in Belfast. Maybe I ought to rephrase that. We're catching the shuttle, Hugo and me, for to give a poetry reading in Belfast. Of course, in adding that little connective for, I'm only affecting the dialect in order to signal TP feels that he never ever really left the place they call the city. That I'm still at home in its speech, even though somewhere along the way my vowels have maybe got shifted or faked. So there's a salt rebuff, as Larkin puts it, in a poem he began not a stone's throw from the room we'll be reading our own stuff in. But look at the problem. What problem? Look at it like this. From for to give to forgive, there's only a syllable blink. So forgive me, Lord, that I caught the Liverpool boat all those years back and then took a train to Hull, where, as it turned out, Larkin was planning High Windows, the poem, the book and the building, and where Douglas Dunn lived in Terry Street, the brick terrace he named his first book for. Andrew Motion flew in later. He too wrote a poem about reading in Belfast. Again, not a stone's throw from where Larkin felt amorous in the Rose Terrace, just over there in Botanic Gardens. Forgive me, Lord, that I only skip back now and then to this city. Blink, blink, a day, a weekend, and no time at all. I'm away in the plane again. And forgive me too that, unlike Hugo, I've not been a freelance writer for the last 20 or more years, but instead have held down a job, held it like a fat, sluggish pollock between my salaried hands. So Hugo, go you on first. You know, some things got stuck in my head. All I can do now is repeat like a mantra, for to give, for to give, for to give. I read, again, this is just a couple of pages. It's about a very ugly word, this poem, crackalure, which is spelt, I'm sure you all know the word, C-R-A-Q-U-E-L-U-R-E. It's the word applied to paint when it cracks on an old painting long after it's dried. It's called crackalure. And I was meditating on this. I suppose I come across it because I spent years writing a book on Hazlitt, and I'd gone down to Maidstone, the museum there. In the vaults, there are these paintings that Hazlitt did which suffer hugely from crackalure because of the kind of paint he used. And I was thinking about this word, and a childhood memory came back to me of being with my mother and a friend of hers on a river in County Down called the River Coyle, where there's an ancient abbey called Inch Abbey. I wrote this poem. I see the word scaldy, which in fact is glossed in the poem, appears. A scaldy is a little, it's before a fledgling, just when the chick comes out of the egg, when its eyes haven't opened. If you get a haircut in the north of Ireland, when you're a kid, the other kids shout scaldy at you. I think it comes from the Old Norse for bald. But that comes into it. In fact, it becomes quite important in this poem. Crackalure, a term, technical term, with no allure. Not unctuous, not brittle like pork crackling. So there's the usual question, why bother? Except it's the germ like seeds in a mummy's stomach of whatever. For clearly, This is an antiquarian subject that's irredeemably committed to the letter and fixed like Boneck or to Cliptometer. It's like writing about the worm in the apple. A worm that's all dry skin and not pliable. Like choosing that instead of a dippling branch or its blossom. Or four greeny blue eggs in a nest. Eggs that will one day, now I see, crack open. So I'll turn to the river coil at neap tide, a dusty car rug on the grass, where each with an easel and a sketch pad, my mother and her friend Kathleen are painting watercolours of the diminished river. A skift of rim comes so close, it nearly spots their paintings as swans go skidding and sliding and splashing along the blue water as they land, and the light in the air are nut fresh, open, chittery. The muddy estuary, mud, not sand, has a dull, wet, mouldy vegetable smell like dead soup or the inside of a cracked downpipe or a broken drain. I find a clay more clay than earthenware bottle in the mud, and in the bottom of the bottle I can make out a dead scaldy, a fledgling. Or at least I think I can. It's a creature neither invented nor dreamed up, just found. And in its being found, small, banal and scruffy, on these somehow anal mudflats. But then, I'm 10 years of age. If it can almost terrify, the scaldy mightn't really exist. It mightn't be in this cold nest, which is therefore a bottle with a smell, but no message. I think what I'll do now is I've got this long poem, The Wind Dog. I read a chunk of it, but I thought I might read a poem. I was stuck in a meeting all day on Friday, and I thought, how can I, you know, cope with being sort of captive here? And I started writing this poem, probably a bit rough at the moment. Obviously, I'm observing the decommissioning argument in the north of Ireland, and although I'm not a unionist, I have a considerable sympathy for the problem David Trimble has in trying to do what happens in all civil war situations, which is square the circle. And I suppose when I think about it, I'd read this essay years ago by Christopher Ricks on Marvell. And he starts talking also about Paul Muldoon and Seamus Heaney, and he says, very interesting essay, if you get a precipice, it's an image that belongs to Civil War poetry. And then somehow ice cream came into this. I think I worked out where that was coming from. Anyway, I've written this poem, I'll read it. It's called Decommissioning, Inevitably. Something to do with precipices and ice cream. And then nothing at all to do with them. I'm tracing whatever. Yeah, whatever. I want to be rocky, ropey, yes, claggy, even ragged. Like the smell of damp newspaper. A smell that's worse than dull. Maybe it's an ice cream parlour, Fusco's on the Ormo Road. A gunman letting himself softly out the back door. I met a son of that family last winter in Moscow. But here and now, there's no thick, innocent snow to soften things, their angles, their hard lines. As we watch David Trimble dangle on a thread, thread or a wire, a command wire that ends in a hazel grove that overlooks an A road, some council houses, and a red phone box in South Armagh. This is what I'm thinking as we all make this next trip back to the brink. It's in me as I take the road past the ice rink, to a house in the river. But the river I see is a greasy groove that might just be the laggin slipping or sliding down to the sea. Would one jammed Armalite, a rusty revolver, and a sweaty wad of Semtex do the trick? It's not likely. As the fabled pikes and 1,000 bits of new and ancient hardware stay rammed in the thatch for the next time or the time after that. No way will it hatch, either the oval or the squared egg of peace, because the Union, what's left of it, the Union was always a dead end, a painted wee corner, whose two high walls echo back no surrender as a pleading boxed in command, surrender. I'll turn from that to this long poem that, I don't know whether I'll get to the part where it actually glosses the title, but I'll see how it goes. This poem began, I suppose, in a way, many, many years ago. I was out in a small boat just off the coast of Donegal with a man I was very fond of, the father of an old school friend of mine, who'd been a merchant seaman, and he came from a place called Port Muck in County Antrim. Muck, I believe, is the Irish for pig, and this is, you know, an island shaped like a pig's back. We were out fishing and came on to rain, and it stopped raining, and he said to me, do you see the on Windog? I said, what do you mean, Windog? He says, broken bit of a rainbow. And then I looked it up in Joseph Wright's Great Dialect Dictionary, where there are a whole series of cognate terms. And it immediately reminded me of reading that poem of Hugh McDermott's. I remember reading it at school, and there's the line, the chittering licht of the water go being another word for rainbow. Rainbow is a hard word to use because it's been used so often. And windog is kind of a rebarbative phrase at the same time, but that's where it came from. And I got asked a few years ago to write a poem, supposedly 20 minutes long, so I won't read the whole thing. It's 17, I think, for the 50th anniversary of Radio 3. And so I wrote this. It's a kind of what's called a cento. It's a patchwork of quotations with bits I've written. The windog. I married a tinker's daughter in the town of Skibbereen. But at last one day she galloped away with me only shirt and a paper bag to the shores of America. Snug as a foot in a moccasin shoe, never the boot, no, never the boot. I lay in Huck's canoe one still night and heard men talking. Clean every word they spoke on the ferry landing, like the Mississippi was a narrow creek you could hear across, plumb as a bell. One man, he reckoned it was near 3 o'clock. He hoped daylight wouldn't wait more than about a week longer. So there I lay, a clog of clay, waiting for the time of day. Logs float down the Mississippi. Logs float down the Mississippi, but don't let's start the whole caper or caber. Don't let's ever grow up. Not to roll out the logos, at least at the start, or say in the beginning was the word. Not to start with a lingo jingo of beginnings, unsheathed like a sword, stiff and blunt like a phallus, or Masonic like a thumb. Not to begin then, arm of Arumque, plush Virgil, but to start with sound, the plunkwa sound of sense, the bite and the kick of it. Green chili, corelli, white mooly radish, all crisp and pepper definite, so my vegetable love did grow, vaster than pumpkins and more slow. For the sound of sense is what the pretend farmer, Farmer Frost, that is, used to call sentence sound, because the sentence he said was a sound in itself on which other sounds called words may be strung, which, never not quite iambic though, is 10 syllables that hang together so, just so. The way the elephant's child took 17 melons, the green crackly kind, and said to all his dear families, goodbye. I'm going to the great grey green greasy Limpopo River, all set about with fever trees, to find out about what the crocodile has for dinner. Just as Rikki-tikki Tavi dates me in a carbon childhood by this huge swollen river all along a mill village, soot, bracken and stone, where Mrs. Jubb and Mr. Jubb, whose leathery right hand had its thumb missing, where they lived in a back-to-back, in a deep warm kitchen with a big kettle like a pet, lived by the music of that bulgy, bulgy river, wider and deeper and slopping at the bank, ever and always, all those torn waters turning dark in maybe October, as though the world itself had become bigger and wilder than the world itself could ever be, because world is suddener than we fancy it, big with itself, gonflé. Now I know the source, the elephant child of the tram, that tatty double-decker that stood out from the others, blue and ice cream white, or fire engine red they were, But the tatty one, that was the fever tram, and it slid sinister along the main, the dangerous main road at the bottom of Wensley Drive in Leeds, Yorkshire, which is a change of sound, accent, place. So let me trawl and list a couple or three sounds in my archive, not the images, not the pictures, there must, because the ear is the only true reader. There must be nothing seen or sighted, no moral message neither, no imperative, because out of the ocean of all sound, one little drop, two little drop, three little drop, shall come forth and fall back as Ricky Ticky, that other, the grey-green, greasy Limpopo River, the green crackly melons and the snake eggs, eggs with a skin, not a shell, that are buried in a melon bed or a crack in a mud wall where Ricky Ticky is snacking on the tops of the eggs. This is like buried Bakelite, the headphones on my crystal set, or the set my strike-breaking uncle built back in the 20s in the attic of 7 Derrimore Drive. He set the aerial on a telegraph pole in the garden of a house called Invergarry, a house off the Malone Road, with tartan curtains, Robertson tartan, and electric bell under the dining room carpet to call the maid, who'd left way back, as surely as Louis McNeice, alias Louis Malone, had left the city on the loch, and then had shuffled off this wiry copper coil long before the city hit the news again. But it's not the dring of that bell I'd press, so my granny'd think it was the front door, it's a woman, a jum. In an untidy room, it's greasy cushions, hookah, a few sweetmeats, green pistachio and a shiny tin plate at the edge of a brass tray. The huge and shapeless woman clad in greenish gauzes and deck, brow, nose, ear, neck, wrist, arm, waist and ankle with heavy native jewellery. When she turned, it was like the clashing of copper pots. Even she banged a bangle against the tray when she lifted it to offer me one of those green sweetmeats, a vein of the gospel proffer, the grub, the prog. You know the cargo cult line? That dirty British coaster, it's cheap tin trays, cheap tin trays. That's the music speaks me, sings me, makes me, cheaps me. But it's also the cheapo rings on a curtain pole, the way they clish-clash too. Something greasy there. Greasy or oily. A mixture of brass and unction like a skitter of listless syllables that makes me ask, what am I hearing? What am I knowing? Or as the woman, the jum and baggy pants, plumps the cushions back into shape. Again the slick slock of her bangles, those silk cushions. The sigh of Hindi being spoken, spoken and then sung, because it's all surface like Matisse, Odalisque Matisse. And I'm a child again, a child that reads and hears but doesn't understand, who neither comprehends this nor that, nor the silk sash my father never wore before the heavens, before the silk sack clouds were filled with a clashing of swords, before I asked Brian Fearn how much his bottle of orange, his bottly orange cost, and he said, "D.D." Then showed me a little brass hexagonal thruppenny bit in the palm of his Catholic hand. So I heard thee for the very first time on the half between North and South Parade, before ever I heard it come back in song. Thee black lumps, said a Herbie shop, candy apples, hard green pears, conversation lozenges, which is all beginning still. Yet if I wanted to put a date when this naked shivering self began to puzzle at print sound, spoken sound, the wind in the reeds or a cry in the street, I'd choose that room for a start. The bangles, the curtain rings, it's my baby tuku, tuku tuku it is. Not the tundish, this is echt British, except that's always fake somehow. It's machinery, means of production, not a spring well. The well of Anglish or the well of Irish undefiled, for it isn't when, but where it happened. Where ice burned and was but the more ice, and salted was my food and my repose, salted and sobered too by the bird's call, the golden bird who perched on his golden bough to sing that ancient salt is best packing, that all that is mortal of great Plato there is stuck like chewed gum in Tess's hair. Which happened as it had to, before ever I seen those tin kippers packed into boxes on the quayside in colour coats or Whitley Bay, and my great aunt takes a penny ferry over the town, and my English, not my Scots granny, calls me Hinny, and it feels that Hoonam Winnie of the northeast coast, almost my love and belonging. So I ask myself, why does Elaine Tweedy say tar, not tar? Why do I glance down at her skirt, yellow and black tartan skirt, when she says it? What is it almost touching me like skin, warm skin? I mean, we live in two streets off the same road, the Ormo Road. Why should we say it different? And why does my mother say modern, not modern? A modern novel, not a modern novel. A fanatic, not a fanatic. Which is a way of saying this is my mother tongue. The gold torque second time out, for out of Ireland have we sort of come. To find in a book called the Hamley Tongue that the word jum means a large, unreliable, trouble-giving car as well. It's a dipstick talking, as a large, lazy, and probably none too clean woman. So did that word, the word jum, bob over the shock to broke, to the river brew, the mud shelf of the bank? Or is it Ulster made? Would you puzzle me that one? Puzzle me proper while I'm out after mackerel in an open boat. Blue, blue sky after a skift of rain, the wet, wondrous sky, stretched tight like a bubble. Hey, Tammy, Jack says, do you see the on windog? Look yonder. What's a windog, Captain? Ach, a wee broken bit of the rainbow. That's a windog. We were neither off Coney Island nor floating down Cypress Avenue. We were out in the Gwabara Bay. So I say to myself, Gwabara, and drive westward, leaving the picky salt miners of Carrickfergus behind, me and that lover of women and Donegal. Ach, Louis, poor Louis, was all Hammond's aunt, the bishop's housekeeper, could say at the end. It was too Louis late to taper. She was too far gone. What with age and with drink? Hardly a mile to go before she sleeps. Hardly a mile to go before she sleeps. There used to be such crack in that kitchen, her and the maid always laughing and yarning, the pair of them. And wee Louis in the room above, hearing the brangle of talk rising through the floorboards. Oh, chitter and chatter and platinum licked, the bow shall be in the clouds, and I will look upon it to remember the everlasting testament between God and all that liveth upon earth, whatsoever flesh or faith it be. They may have turned Tyndale into tinder, but the bow he wrought lives high in this wet blue sky. I'll stop there.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you. Thank you for reading the long piece, but also thank you for bringing along this.
Oh, I
can tell for the archives of the university and sell for many dollars now. This is your opportunity now to ask questions to Tom. I shall leave you to think of some questions. Could you put the lights up, please? In the sound box, sir. Thanks. So I can see you. But I shall take the chair's prerogative. It's a bit of a naughty question, really. You are an academic of note, an essayist, and a sublime writer of poems. And you take words in all their prickly life and you reinvent them, reuse them, and relive them. Do you really enjoy all the stuff that you do for the telly?
Yeah.
Where does the impulse come from to do those deeds?
I don't know. I think if you know, I've spent my life teaching. I've been teaching for nearly 30 years, I suppose. And you teach within institutions, but doing television programs, really there is what's called a public service broadcasting remit in the BBC charter, which is, I think, basically it's educational, it's fun working with people.
I like the idea that to take these on, these things on as a form of service. And to use the word teach even more widely there.
I don't know how. A lot of the stuff you have to look at is rubbish, really, I think, it is. I mean, most films are rubbish. They are.
That could lead on to the question I want to add on there, which is
you see other
about controversy. I mean, the statement is a controversial one. It causes debate, it provokes it. You preface one of the poems with, you're writing a poem to annoy. It's a position that I've got a great deal of sympathy with. But is controversy an end in itself, as it was for Milton, or is it an end in itself?
Well, I think there might be two answers to that. I have a great admiration for Swift, who said that he wanted to vex the reader. On the other hand, I think that one of the problems with studying with criticism, but different views need to collide. And you know, I think that's a good thing. Just as, you know, convivially, if you're with a group of friends, you might start arguing about something. And the argument is a complete thing, I think. As you find times if you're teaching and you've got a class and somehow everything just sort of gels together and it's kind of unrepeatable, I think.
Mm-hmm. I want, of course, our audience to gel together in a similar way, and we don't want to vex you.
You can vex me, all right.
But we indeed vex away. Can I take some questions, please? Sorry, I shall do that.
Yeah, yes. Tom, you know, when you write poems, I mean, they kind of take off like doves or ravens in one direction or another. What I'm wondering is, when you write poems about Northern Ireland, do you hope that they have a particular direction in which to go?
Well, it would depend. I mean, you know, sometimes you might be wanting to attack or support a particular position, but that would just be occasionally. I mean, it's difficult to talk about, but I've long been fascinated by what happened in England after the Civil War, when writers like Dryden, mainly royalist writers, worked to construct a kind of neoclassical culture. And you know, so you feel that, you know, you're maybe throwing something out that may be part of you know, whatever the culture would be deemed eventually to be. And that, you know, I can remember when Seamus Heaney's first volume, Death of the Naturalist, was published. There was no publishing firm in the north of Ireland. There was really almost nobody writing, no literary magazine, no focus. And over the years, things have changed. So you'd be thinking, I mean, you would just write because you wanted to, you know. That would be it. If you were doing, trying to do a translation, you might be thinking slightly more civic-minded way, I suppose.
Yeah. Further questions?
All right, we'll go here first. Yeah.
Is this salary yours? In your poem about your jewelry and the scripture of Belfast.
Yeah.
You've been a freelance writer.
Yes.
You had your salary and I forget the line, but your comfortable hands. Do you have a feeling of any force outside that poem that maybe your poetry would have been different it's hard to imagine better, but do you have a sense that it might have been different in a better way if you hadn't, for one reason or another, lived your work your life as an academic?
Well, I've always sort of had the views, possibly a rather sort of romantic adolescent view, that really one should have just stuck to the one thing. And I do know people who have lived on the bread line and like that, and not compromised. Yeah, I do. At the same time, I admire, you know, I think of Wallace Stevens as the insurance executive, that kind of doubleness. But my analogy for that has always been, you know, it's like being Guy Burgess. You know, you're you're working for Ernie Bevan, but, you know, you're smuggling cabinet secrets to the KGB. There's a sort of doubleness there. And I was always fascinated by, you know, John le Carré, when he was working in the British Embassy in Bonn, and I suppose he was a spy, but he used to get up very early in the morning and start, you know, he started writing. It was a spy who came in from the cold like that. And it's that kind of treacherous doubleness that I wonder about too. But if you did the one thing, you wouldn't be a treacherous double agent, I think. Huh? And you'd be purer.
Could be that. Yep.
The form of the poems in this collection appears quite loose on the surface, with lots of cat and sound and so on.
Sorry, what does?
It appears quite loose in the form of the poetry.
Yeah.
Lack of punctuation and so on. Punctuation by dashes. How far do you see this going? Is that something you've been developing through your world over the last few years?
You wouldn't ever know where you were going. You just follow your nose, really, or your ear, you know. But then you wouldn't be sure, you know, whether what you hear, you only think you can hear, and, you know, other people don't. So I imagine a certain kind of dissonance that so collides with itself, it gets completely stuck. I don't know what would.
How does it work out with the composition of the pieces? Because you have this line about reading with your ear, which is rather like the idea of the Mandelstam had, where you hear the form, you hear the music of the language first. You hear the poem, you hear the poem's whole, you hear the music of the poem, and
yeah,
then the words come maybe a week or two afterwards. With the Wind Dog itself, it's an interesting form, it's an exciting form. How did that get written? How did you hear that? Because as you read it, it's written to be heard.
Well, I wrote it I got asked to do it, and I was working on Hazlitt, and Hazlitt uses this term cento, which is, I think it's Latin and Italian for patchwork, and he says, he has this essay on Shakespeare and Milton, and he says, Milton was the greatest writer of centos, but in originality, second only to Homer. And I know Eliot read the adjacent essay on Pope and Dryden, because he quotes from it to say that Hazlitt had perhaps the least interesting mind of all our great critics, and gets rid of him like that. I love the use of perhaps. It's just, you know, really feeling. But then, you see, Eliot wrote The Wasteland, which is a cento and is a version of the epic poem, and I wonder whether it came from there. And Hazlitt's father set up the Unitarian Church in Boston that Eliot's family went to. There's a sort of connection there. But what happened to me was I got asked to do this, and I thought, well, you know, I can't write a long poem, no idea. And then something came into my head, and I had to go up on the train to just outside Newcastle on Tyne, where my last surviving aunt was dying of cancer, and I started writing this poem on the train, and I wrote most of it on the train up there and back. And I mean, I don't know, but I was kept thinking of, because I mean, I used to visit this little place, Tynemouth, on the coast when I was very small, and I guess I started thinking about childhood and those special books you read when you're a child that stay with you. Kipling would be one of them, you know, just bits flying around like that. That's how I wrote it.
Yep.
I haven't read all of it, but I've been seeing your book on the husband. And what's going to cost you already is that after all the research and the years you've spent looking at his life, that there's no sense of him in the book. And I was just wondering if there's anything that you haven't been able to discover about his life, for example. If there's any question you could ask him, what would it be? Is there a sense of his life that you just haven't been able to?
Well, the question I'm interested in, and I was just talking to a friend of mine, Duncan Wu, who's done the big edition of Hazlitt recently and is writing a biography of Hazlitt. And Duncan has done a lot of work on Hazlitt's father, who came from Ireland to study in the University of Glasgow and was influenced by teachers who'd been taught by Francis Hutcheson, the founder, really, of the Scottish Enlightenment, who came from the north of Ireland. But I have this sense that Hazlitt's father was somehow affiliated to the United Irishmen, the revolutionary organisation. He and his wife, you know, Hazlitt's mother, looked after a niece of Robert Emmet's. And I'm interested in that kind of thing to do with, you know, his background. In the biography, I'm in a way I can't answer your question. I wonder. Yes. No, I can't think of a particular, because I mean, I did a bit of work on the biography, but not very much. Yeah, you've got me there.
Mm-hmm. So if you were able to email him over time, is there anything you could maybe say?
Sorry?
If you could email him over time, is there anything that you could say to Hazlitt or advise him or suggest? Should he be living at this hour?
I'm thrown by this. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, I'll give you her email, and you can answer it in 3 days from Oxford. A couple more questions, perhaps, and then maybe we'll get on to the books.
Yeah.
Sorry.
You said when you were writing the fact of Windock that one of the things you're exploring is what is poetry. So
What is it? Well, if I could put it like this, I didn't read the poem, but when I was at school, my English teacher had a record, little EP record. This is, you know, like, you know, you don't get them nowadays, 45 RPM. Yeah. And it had Robert Frost reading After Apple Picking on it. About the same time, I had a very dear relative, a great aunt, who spent her life as a primary school teacher in the East End of London, and for, I think it was maybe my 16th or 17th birthday, she sent me this little Fontana paperback called Modern Poets on Poetry, and it had all big essays like Tradition and the Individual Talent and Wallace Stevens and heavy essays. But the only bit of it I really read, I mean, I looked at it, but, you know, I got lost in those essays. I was, you know, doing A-levels. Was a few pages by Robert Frost on, I mean, I kept recurring to this, I realised what I was reading this evening, on sentence sound, where Frost says that poetry, at least his kind of poetry, is made out of how we speak. We speak in complete sentence sounds. You know, an example would be, you know, somebody comes and leaves the door open, you say, "Go you and shut that door," and that would be a complete thing. I got fascinated by that, and by Edward Thomas's poetry, and then years later, I realised that. For Seamus Heaney and for Paul Muldoon, Frost was a key figure. His work spoke to, you know, a particular, you know, couple of generations and more, because the poet John Hewitt, a much older poet, now dead, knew Frost's work. And so, I mean, I'm going to give a class on Frost tomorrow. Frost is a crucial figure. Frost is just quite extraordinary poet, whereby he, I mean, he writes a poem like The Woodpile, and you think, yeah, this is about, you know, a few bits of wood out in the swamp. And then I realised that behind the woodpile are some lines from Shelley's Adonais about the wall round the English graveyard in Rome, like wood that's burning slowly, which Frost ends up with, you know, the slow, smokeless burning of decay. And that behind it then is a whole neoclassical idea that you get in Jefferson. And behind it is Poussin's painting Et in Arcadio Ego. For most readers of the poem, it's a terrific homespun poem about this abandoned pile of wood in the wilderness. And so Frost, who's a much greater classicist, much more gifted classicist than Eliot, is able to do two opposite things: appeal to a huge audience and then bring in, you know, implicitly all sorts of references to the classics. So I'm very, very fascinated by Frost. He manages to be both a popular poet and a poet's poet at the same time. And I do remember some years ago Paul Muldoon saying, you know, he thought Frost was the greatest 20th century poet. So I'm very fascinated by him, and very grateful for having been given the opportunity, you know, to study him. And in fact, I mean, I see my old English teacher probably several times a year, and he gave me the record eventually. Yeah, and now, you know, the last poem in the book is sort of a wee light one about him. Yeah,
mm-hmm. I'll take one maybe to Sarah Maitland.
Oh, paintings, yeah.
Not a reference to painting, but painting studies did that. And particularly in relation to what you just said, very little to music. And I think that's quite unusual.
Yeah.
In our contemporary music. Because you kind of struggle up together. And you really, I couldn't work out. The Shepherd picture is not about surface. I just wonder why this kind of
Well, yeah, I mean, one, I can't paint, and I was talking to the Irish poet Reds and the Irish Nuala Nigonal about it a few months ago, and I said, you know, I says, Nuala, I'm very worried over all these poems about painting, and she said, ah, well, I think it's a phase you go through. she says, Derek Mahon went through it, you know, I said, right, that's fine. Music, I mean, I like listening to music, but honestly, I find it impossible to almost to recognise anything. You know, I could recognise the Pastoral Symphony, I could do that, you know, and a few, you know, really, really old chestnuts, but I have no knowledge of it. I mean, I mean, I should try and all that. I'm just hopelessly unmusical, you know.
I don't want to be on music. It's just it's very interesting.
Well, I have one little poem towards the end. It was just, I mean, I think it was like last year. I was at. It was an occasion of Bernard Donoghue and I were reading, and there was Irish music, and there was a very gifted fiddler there, but I began to worry whether her fiddle hadn't perhaps a sort of tone that I found slightly rebarbative. And then I felt guilty about that because, you know, I wouldn't be able to, you know, I don't know anything about music or instruments. So I tried to write about that. It's very hard to talk about music. I mean, I do like listening to music, but it's almost as always like the first time, you know. When you're listening to it.
So I suppose that first one of the TV programmes you'd be lousy on is Never Mind the Buzzcocks.
Never Mind what?
The Buzzcocks.
Oh, I don't know what that is.
It's very interesting. You look back into classicism and you stop with Purcell. I just thought that was a very good talking about the role of that,
you know,
back to a picture.
Yeah.
Rather than the classical picture, rather than.
Than what in something in musical terms.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to bring the discussion to a close right now, but I'm going to ask you a favour, Tom, which is a kind of formal closure to make the arc leap together, which is to ask you to read the poem that you've been talking about, not musical, on page 78. But before you do, don't forget, when the poem is over, go you to the door and open it, and then go you to the bookshop, and and they're all waiting. But then come back.
Okay, yeah, I'll read this. Yes, it is very short. It's just a couple of short stanzas. not musical. Something in the fiddle's tone that I can't know. I know, which is only to say that its sound, its slow, strutty glumness, is too thrown. As I hear in its belly an off-colour sound like furred echoes in a cellar. And as her bow fray under, not over, its yelping stresses, all I know is the clash of consonants, their broken, jaggy tune like a chuff's call, the way they scrape or scringe or smash. I have no right to say this, no right to speak at all. Thank you.